Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Couple of weeks ago, a new patient came in, and they handed me this big report, like almost 50 pages, from a company called Viome. And they said, well, you know, what do you think of this? And as I looked at it, I was very confused. And, you know, I'm a person who thinks she knows a lot about the microbiome. It's been kind of an obsession with me for quite a while. And I realized that this Viome company was making all kinds of recommendations, like very, very granular, specific recommendations. Eat lettuce, not kale. And I was very, very intrigued by that. And so I looked through the report, and it lists all of the bacteria that are in this person's microbiome. But I was, unlike the product that I use when I do my analysis, it didn't have which, by the way, costs half what this one costs. It didn't give you the numbers, and clearly it's not just what's in there, but the relative propensity or the relative abundance that's going to make a difference in terms of function. So that was perplexing. Then, besides not giving you any volume of the thing, it didn't give you any information about the bacteria. There were no links that you could press on that would tell you what the bacteria were important for, and without relative abundance, you can't even make a call on this. And furthermore, I really was scratching my head because I went to the website and I went looking for references or support or any information about how they got from this bacterial analysis to very specific granular things, and there wasn't anything. And I realized what I was looking at was crowdsourced data, which isn't the way you need to study this stuff, really. We're not ready to use machine learning and crowdsourced. And everywhere I looked, it was like, well, we have a proprietary algorithm. And it's like, oh, great, you and your proprietary algorithm. It sounds a lot like when somebody comes in with a health food formula, and I look at it, and it says, oh, this has a proprietary blend, and it lists, maybe it's a prostate drug, and it lists nettle and saw palmetto, but it lists a bunch of other things and vitamins and minerals that I'm kind of scratching my head going, I don't remember read that that had anything particular to do with prostate health, certainly not as an action item. And then I realized I don't know how much saw palmetto is in this, so I don't know if they're getting 30 milligrams or 300. The dose, by the way, would be 300 a day in all of the science. So this company isn't backing itself up. I did a little bit more searching around, and I found a blog that was really very nice blog that a guy had done comparing Viome and Day 2, which is another one of these microbiome analysis tools. And I'd actually seen a presentation by the Day 2 people when I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and they had shown that they were very science-based. They were primarily looking at diabetes. They had a lab in Israel that had been doing work for literally decades, and they had a ton of good data. And what they were purporting to do was say whether or not and how you needed to modify your diet to improve your glycemic response. And this seemed rather science-based. In fact, I went ahead and purchased the kit. I haven't turned it in yet, so I will keep you posted on the information I get. But what this particular blog, and I shall post a link in the resource section of our website because I do think it's very good. He compared the two, and he compared the science. And I will just say that Viome came up short across everywhere, and I think it is bogus based on what I've looked at so far. So the Viome people, you have a challenge here. If you want to talk to me and make me eat my words, then you're going to have to show me some science or some evidence and not just hide behind proprietary platform, because this doesn't make sense that you'd be able to do this. Another comment that our blogger made, which I think is quite relevant here, is that day two plus the lab that I use uses DNA. DNA is really, really stable. You can dig DNA out of a 20,000-year-old mammoth bone. RNA, on the other hand, which is what Viome uses, while it does tell you what's going on metabolically in the bacteria, because it tells you what genes the bacteria are expressing, that would be really great if you could get fresh poop that hadn't had a chance to deteriorate. But when you're having people mail order poop, that's a false premise. And so the correlation, if this is a good study, the correlation between the DNA that's found in, and the bacteria that are related to that DNA should be very high with the RNA. In fact, you could use these existing DNA studies as a way of validating a bacterial RNA-based product. And if you do that, it comes up pretty short. The correlation was poor. And given the science, literally we have 20 years of good data now based on DNA, I don't feel that RNA testing is ready for prime time. So I am recommending against Viome. I also noticed they are advertising the hell out of this. And that's not a good sign when you've got a field like this, because if they're advertising it really hard, but they don't provide any persuasive evidence of why you should use it except a slick sales pitch, my advice is steer away from this one. And I'll get back to you on the day two thing. I'm not ready to recommend it yet. I'm still in my investigation phase. But I am pleased to know that at least one blogger out there thinks it's the better product, because the minute I saw that Viome report, I really had my doubts. And everything I found today when I was doing a little more background research, including looking at sample reports on Viome, it's like, yeah, this reads like a horoscope and not like an astronomy chart. And we're going to move right away to an email. This from David in Fairbanks. I presume that's Alaska. Hi there, David. Anyway, blood pressure confused. Thank you, Dr. Don. I'm confused about when one's blood pressure should be measured for greatest accuracy. I've always been told that resting blood pressure is most accurate. On a recent dental appointment, my hygienist put a weighted wrist cuff on me, and I was told to hold it up like doing a curl in the weight room. I keep a wrist cuff next to my bed. I use it before getting out of bed in the morning or after an afternoon nap. My numbers are about 105 over 65 at those times. Numbers are higher at the doctor's office. Can you tell me which of the two measurement times are most accurate? I am 58 years old, 6 feet tall, 182 pounds, and never miss a show, and I'm so grateful for you. Thanks again, David. There's a lot to unpack here, but it's all good information. So I'm going to start with a comment on wrist cuffs. Wrist cuffs are not as accurate across a population as a cuff that's on the bicep. So when my patient wants to use a wrist cuff, I'm fine with that, but I make them bring it in, and we check their blood pressure with the wrist cuff held in the appropriate position, which is the wrist over the heart. Then we check their blood pressure with a biceps cuff with their arm in an appropriate position, which is to say the arm should be propped up at the same level as the heart. We'll come back to positioning in just a second, because that also has some factors. And if the two are within 5 points of each other on the same arm, then I'm good with it. I do the wrist cuff first, and you'll understand why I do that in a minute. Now, if I'm in the dental hygienist's office, or rather, if I'm the dental hygienist, I know that people get apprehensive in a dental office, so I might want to use one of several tricks to make sure that they've got an acceptable blood pressure so that we don't have a delay in doing their dental cleaning, back up the schedule, you know, end up sending them to their doctor on a false alarm, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I might, for example, have the patient raise their arm a little higher than their heart, and particularly with the wrist cuff, that's going to give you a lower blood pressure. I might Have the person exercise a little bit. Use the weighted cup. I'm wondering if holding that weight up wouldn't constitute a little bit of exercise. You see, when you exercise your muscles, the blood supply needs to increase, and so there is a thing called exercise-induced vasodilation. Another trick, another way that you can get a low blood pressure is to check it two or three times and take the last measurement and do it slowly. So when I pump up that cuff, I'm cutting off blood to your arm. And if I slowly, slowly let it come off, and those automated machines are pretty darn slow. So if you took the best of three, and it's always going to be the last one. And the reason for that is after you starve the arm for blood, the blood vessels open up a little bit more than normal. And because the pipe is bigger, you actually get post-ischemic vasodilation, and it'll lower the blood pressure. So what I'm saying here is that technique really matters. And when they do research, of course, they're in a lab. They're not in a medical practice. So the proper way, if you're going to be a stickler about this, the proper way to check blood pressure is the patient needs to be seated with their back supported and their feet on the ground, not sitting on an exam table, for example. They need to not have been talking for 5 minutes, because talking gets you excited, especially nowadays. And then you check their blood pressure with their arm lifted to the height to be at a level with their heart. And then you get a measurement that is, when you see all of those, what is a good blood pressure? What is it supposed to be? All of those are based on that very strict scientific criteria, which in practice, nobody ever can do. So most of the chairs in medical offices don't either don't support your back or don't let your feet hit the ground. Most of the time you're on an exam table. Most of the time, you've just walked in to a space. You haven't been sitting for 5 minutes. So we violate that rule constantly, and thus blood pressures fluctuate quite a bit. Now, the most important blood pressure, there's two things that you can do, David. One of which is, you said your numbers are 105 in the morning, and so make sure that your wrist is held over your heart. And I think it sounds from your description like you're doing that. And then the other thing you want to see is you want to see it lower in the evening. Say if you go to bed at 11, around 9 p.m., the blood pressure should be lower. If it's not lower then you've lost your normal circadian rhythm. Blood pressures just before bed should drop, and if they don't, then you're starting to develop maybe some atherosclerosis. That's something that you should look at. There is a spike of blood pressures in the wee hours of the morning, so if you were to get up to pee at 4 in the morning and check your blood pressure, you might find that it was even 10 or 15 points higher. That's due to a cortisol surge and an adrenaline surge, which is part of your body getting ready to wake up. So I hope you've enjoyed my somewhat detailed description of blood pressure and its discontents. We're going to move now to our first medical story. I'd have to call the thing about Viome a little bit of an editorial in my classifications. This was a very interesting study about running, and it was an observational study, and it was retrospective. So from scientific standpoints, it doesn't have a great deal of value, but it's interesting because of what they did find. This was a big study looking at 232,000 people. In all of these studies, they had been tracked for between 5 and 35 years. And during the time of this various studies, they put together 14 different studies, about 25,000 people died. When they put the studies together and asked about running, what they found was that any amount of running was associated with a 27% lower risk of all-cause mortality for both sexes. So running was really good for you. I want to point out these studies did control for disease. So these were healthy, quote unquote, nominally healthy people. So we aren't looking at people who were morbidly obese and so they weren't running and comparing them to thin people who were able to run. Even small doses of running, like for example, once a week for or less, and even at speeds below 6 miles an hour, which is kind of a trot, is still associated with significant health and longevity benefits. So 25 minutes, even less than the weekly duration of exercise, even a little bit, was very helpful. So if you don't have severe ankle, foot, or knee problems, and if you do, then you'll want to work with a physical therapist and a physiatrist, that is to say a physician that specializes in either sports medicine or rehab, to try to get to the point where you can run. And if you simply can't run, walking quickly is probably a good second, although in this study that wasn't the parameter they measured. The point is, a little bit of exercise is way better than no exercise. More is better. But just getting off the dime and exerting yourself for even a half an hour once a week makes a substantial difference in your long-term survival. Our next story is about sleep and what kind of sleep precisely you need to soothe anxiety. There's a quote from Macbeth in which the Dane of Cawdor, I think, or maybe he was the Bane of Cawdor. No, I think it was the Dane of Cawdor. That's Macbeth. Refers to sleep as the balm of hurt minds. And of course, Lady Macbeth is known for her sleepwalking. And obviously quite anxious, trying to get that blood off her hands. A sleepless night can trigger a measurable rise in anxiety levels, actually 30%. And this research comes out of the University of California, Berkeley. The researchers used functional MRI and polysomnography. So these are very objective measures. And they had 18 young adults, probably university students at Berkeley, and they tested them by having them view emotionally stirring clips, either after a full night of sleep or after a sleepless night. They measured anxiety after using a questionnaire known as State Trait Anxiety Inventory, and this is something that is a what we call a validated study. I have not looked it up, so I have no idea how it works. After a night of no sleep, brain scans showed a shutdown of the medial prefrontal cortex. This is part of the executive functioning of the brain that keeps our anxiety in check. This, when you start to run away and perseverate and think, oh my God, I'm going to get audited. Oh my God, that mole is a skin cancer. And you start to kind of loop and it begins invading your head. There's a part of your brain that says, no, dude, just chill. Okay. It's probably just a freckle. You found it. It's small. You'll get to the doctor. You get an appointment next Thursday. They'll take a look at it. They'll get it figured out. You know, don't worry so much. Let's think about something else. And that sort of, I don't know, it's kind of like the voice of your internal parent is really, really disabled after a night of no sleep. It's as if the brain loses its break on the emotions when there's sleeplessness. The type of sleep, because remember they were doing polysomnography, so they were able to measure the brainwaves, was not REM sleep, which is what I would have thought it would be, but actually non-rapid eye movement, slow wave sleep. And this is sometimes called the deep sleep. In functional medicine, we call it detox sleep, because that's when your body really gets to work on getting rid of all of the physiological toxins that you need to deal with. Interesting, isn't it, that detox might also, at least as far as the brain is concerned, be a situational detox that's going on. The anxiety levels declined greatest in the people in the study who had the most slow wave REM sleep. I've got a little bit of additional information for you that's not in the study. In addition to the lab experience, the researchers did an online study in which they tracked 280 people of all ages, asking them both about how their sleep and their anxiety levels changed over four subsequent days. So the amount of quality of sleep that a person got from one night to the next predicted how anxious they would feel the next day very significantly. And even subtle nightly changes, like having to get up three times to pee as opposed to once, made a difference. The researchers comment at the end of their study, people with anxiety disorders routinely report having disturbed sleep, but rarely is sleep improvement considered as a clinical recommendation for lowering anxiety. Our study not only establishes a causal connection between sleep and anxiety, but it identifies exactly the kind of deep, non-REM sleep we need to calm the brain. And here's where functional medicine comes in, because in functional medicine, we target anxiety with sleep. This is a first step in trying to get the adrenal glands back into a normal state of regulation. And adrenal dysregulation, where you're not getting that spike of adrenaline at the right moment, but instead you're getting it, at 10 o'clock at night, which is not a good time to have a spike of adrenaline. That's the sort of thing that leads to a self-perpetuating cycle of anxiety and poor sleep and more anxiety. And this study provides a lot of evidence to support this technique that is a time-honored technique going back probably to, as far back as maybe the 70s or the 80s in functional medicine. And if you look at things like Oriental medicine or Ayurveda, the connection between sleep and anxiety is solid. And some of these disciplines go back to very, very ancient texts dating from, a couple thousand years BC. So we're not talking about anything that's new, but it's interesting that our latest, most sophisticated tools only serve to validate these time-honored concepts. So if you're having trouble with anxiety, you need to get some sleep, and you don't want to take standard sleeping pills to get it, because those suppress the non-REM sleep. So let me tell you what does work to improve non-REM sleep that is available, not over the counter, but it's an old prescription drug. These go way, way back. They're called tricyclic antidepressants. And when Prozac came along in, I guess it would have been the late 80s and became available, we dropped, as physicians, we dropped the others like a lead balloon. And the reason we did that was that when you use a tricyclic antidepressant at the therapeutic doses, the people get very drowsy and their mouth gets dry and they don't want to take the pills. And if they do take the pills and start to feel better, when a person who's super depressed starts to feel better, that's when their suicide risk actually increases, because now they have more initiative. Depression saps your initiative, and the first thing to recover is the initiative, but you still feel sad. So any antidepressant, and all of them do this, increase the suicide risk in the short term, in the immediate term, until the depression is handled. And look it up. Look in the PDR. You'll see it's true for all of the antidepressants we have. So we were giving people a lethal drug, because if you take an overdose of tricyclic antidepressants, you mess up your heartbeat and you put yourself into a very dangerous sudden death sort of situation cardiac-wise. So we didn't like to give loaded guns to people who might use them, but that's exactly what we were doing. So that's why we embraced the serotonin reuptake blockers, because they were like, oh my God, you can't kill yourself with this stuff. How cool is that? The old tricyclics at very tiny doses. So therapeutically, you might use 150 and 300 for depression. For this purpose, I might use 10 milligrams, not 150 milligrams. So we're literally talking a 15th to a 30th of the therapeutic dose. But if you take that at bedtime, it magically increases non-REM sleep. And so if I've got a person, I also use this one in my fibromyalgia patients, if I can get them to take it, but unfortunately they go online and they look up the package insert and they freak out. At these doses, these are very benign agents, and I've used them therapeutically a lot. And in the wake of this study and what I know about non-REM sleep and the tricyclics, I think I'm going to start dusting these off and trying them in my more anxious patients who are coming in with insomnia and hypervigilance at night, because I might actually be able, within a few weeks, to really turn that around. Very exciting, and something I'm going to be able to I don't want to use the word weaponize. Let's say it's actionable information, and that's my favorite kind. This next story is just weird. It's a combination of, well, let's say new technology and science fiction and old tech. And it also reminds me of my favorite science fiction work by Margaret Atwood. She's the Handmaid's Tale lady. But if you're a science fiction fan, I highly recommend Oryx and Crake, a post-apocalyptic novel about genetic manipulation that, among other things, features what we're about to talk about today, a smart toilet. The smart toilet is a concept that is in development. Urine contains a virtual liquid history of the individual's nutritional habits, exercise, medication use, sleep patterns, and other lifestyle choices. It also contains metabolic links to more than 600 different conditions, including some of the big ones like cancer, diabetes, and kidney disease. You also get clues about the microbiome, and I'll explain how that works in a minute. I use urine, and I do something called urine organic acid testing. Organic acids are the breakdown products of a lot of compounds, and when they come out through the urine, they can give you a lot of details. For example, if I eat starch and I have yeast in my gut at higher than very trace amounts, and that yeast is alive and metabolizing, there are certain organic acids that will be present in my urine that wouldn't be otherwise, because you see, the bacteria and my cells don't metabolize the fiber the same way, or the carbohydrate the same way. And so these are unique signatures for fungal organisms. So it tells you you've got a fungus among us, not just contaminant, because DNA could be from something that I ate, like a moldy piece of bread. But if it's making these organic acid compound, it's alive and metabolizing inside that gut of mine. So a small pilot study was published in the November 11th issue of the Nature Digital Medicine. And in it, two research subjects collected all urine specimens over a 10-day period, and they ran those tests through gas chromatography and mass spectrometry and got a complete readout of metabolic signatures. They did about 110 samples. These were two of the lead authors on this study. They also used wearable technology that tracked their heart rates, their steps. They tracked calorie consumption. They tracked sleep patterns, just about everything they could. They also kept records, how much coffee, how much alcohol. And one subject took some acetaminophen. So that showed up in the urine as a spike in ion intensity. Not being at all familiar with the physics of that, I'm just reading it. They could also measure metabolic outputs from sleep and exercise, because there are changes in the metabolism and shifts that are associated with both of these activities. So they got a remarkable health fingerprint on these individuals. So now what they plan to do is build a toilet with a portable mass spectrometer in it. They're going to use it to recognize individuals and process samples. They're basically going to build it and keep it in their research lab and pick about a dozen people. And they're going to see if they can tell people apart by their urine. Certainly my dog can. So I'm thinking that that a mass spectrometer probably won't have any difficulty either. You'll also be able to maybe tell when someone is getting sick. Maybe you get a change when they've got a bacterial infection. Probably you get a change when they're coming down with a virus, because it'll alter their metabolism. We also might be able to get information about how an individual is metabolizing their prescription drugs. Are they potentially making a toxic intermediate? This happens with Tylenol, for example, in people with certain DNA. People who are using drugs for pharmaceutical drugs, an older population, the smart toilet might be able to indicate whether they're actually taking their drugs and whether the drugs are having their intended effect, or in fact, whether we need to reduce the dose or even eliminate a drug because it's not doing what it's supposed to do. The smart toilet concept could also have major population health implications. And you might be able to have real diagnostic capacities if you got tens of thousands of users. It costs about $300,000 for the mass spec that they're doing, but portable mass spec technologies exist at about a tenth of that cost. Potentially, he says, it might even be something that could be affordable, relatively affordable, at least for a substantial portion of the population, say those one percenters. The insurance companies might start buying you a smart toilet if it showed that it reduced your risk, or particularly in high-risk individuals with known metabolic abnormalities, this might not be such a bad thing. What if you could predict a seizure by changes in the urine? Not at all unlikely, given how profoundly what we pee out reflects what is going on physiologically in our body. A lot to unpack there, but certainly fascinating science. I had a comment from the audience. A small portable mass spectrometer was first developed by NASA to use on Mars. How about that? Mass spec on Mars, mass spec in your toilet. One large leap for mankind, one small step for a man. All right. More about predicting based on physiology and things we can measure. This latest study came from Psychological Science, and it looked at fat profiles in the blood at birth with psychological health at the age of 5, and they found significant correlations between certain types of cholesterol and certain types of fats in the blood and cognitive development and emotional development at the age of 5. And how strange is that? So in this study, 1,300 children were tracked from birth to the age of 5. Psychological scientists found a standard blood test taken at birth, and they were measuring lipid profiles. This comes out of Stanford University and the University of Denver. Doctors Gottlieb and Mansek, respectively, they looked at triglycerides, HDL and LDL. Okay, we think of LDL as the bad cholesterol and HDL as the healthy cholesterol. Studies were born in the town of Bradford in the United Kingdom between March of 2007 and December of 2010. 1,369 children and various ethnic backgrounds of the mother. When the kids got to 3, the mothers were asked to rate their child's health. When they were 4 or 5, their teachers rated them on their psychological development, including self-confidence, emotional control, and interpersonal relationships. They were also asked to classify the child at below, at, or exceeding developmental expectations. The newborn's cord blood, who showed the highest levels of HDL, that's the good cholesterol, were significantly more likely to later receive high ratings on psychological development by their teachers. In contrast, those whose cord blood tested high for triglycerides and very low density lipoprotein, one of the worst of the bad cholesterols, were more likely to receive low teacher ratings on social and emotional development. And this was consistent across ethnic groups and gender. This is a correlation. This is a beautiful example of the difference between correlation and causation. Lipid profiles at birth could have some predictive value. Maybe we could look at the children with the adverse profile and do early intervention. That would make sense because it's probably acting as a marker. Could it be mom's insulin levels during pregnancy? That would certainly raise the triglycerides and lower the HDL. That's known a physiologic effect. Could pre-diabetes in the mother, or just a low-grade insulin resistance, very common during pregnancy, but below the threshold where we would call it pregnancy-induced diabetes, could that be the factor that influences the blood? And of course, we know that insulin is pro-inflammatory. And if insulin is higher, it's going to set things like appetite, which would then manifest perhaps as a propensity to eat more sugar. And we know that that is inflammatory. So could there be more brain inflammation in the children? Could it be associated with the mother's anxiety state? If the mother had more adrenaline, that could conceivably raise levels of triglycerides. That's a known physiological response as well. So an anxious mother, well, first of all, there's the prenatal epigenetic effects of having an anxious mom, which tends to make the baby more anxious. And if they're adopted, this is true in mice and humans, if they're adopted to a calm mother, then that goes away. But if they stay with the anxious mother, then they become anxious themselves. Even though it's not genetic, it is hereditary. So could that later show up as social and emotional development changes? Of course it could. I think that that's a very, very likely reason for the association. So before we go thinking that it's lipids, we need to stop and think about, could it be what we call a third variable issue, which means that what A is not causing B, there's a hidden factor C that is causing both A and B and tying A and B together such that we make the mistake of associating them. A classic example of that is, in fact, total cholesterol. Okay, we made the total cholesterol and heart disease connection, right? And we made that because we saw a consistent correlation between high blood cholesterol and heart disease. This is back, you know, in the 60s that this association was made. The problem is it's been refuted over and over again. It is not the high cholesterol that causes the heart disease. Cholesterol is a substrate which, in the presence of inflammation, gets incorporated into the arteries. Playing around trying to develop a pharmaceutical, we came up with the statins, derived actually from an ancient Chinese herbal formula to help treat heart disease, oddly enough. Red yeast rice is a type of yeast that turns rice red, and when you take that and extract it, you get a bunch of compounds that correspond biochemically to the statin drugs. And yes, they lower cholesterol, but they also are very good anti-inflammatories. And all of the subsequent data that emerges in the second half of the decade of the 90s and throughout the 2000s and to this day make it very clear that it is the anti-inflammatory effect of the statins that does you any good. There's lots of data to support that. I won't go into all of it, but the important take-home thing here is that this was a classic third variable problem. A associates with B, so we think A is causing B. We get a drug that lowers A, and lo and behold, B goes down. So now we're really convinced that A causes B, but it turns out that's not what's going on, because the statin is doing something else. It's changing another thing that is absolutely necessary for the development of heart disease, and that's the inflammation. And we now have basically proof positive of that, because there are about three or four other drugs that lower cholesterol. Zetia comes to mind. The bile acid sequestrants like cholestyramine. These drugs have never been shown, and they have consistently been shown not to reduce the rate of heart attacks, even though they lower the cholesterol. Now, isn't that interesting? But we're still trying to reach that magic number. We're still trying to reach that number and not paying attention to inflammation. I had a patient in the hospital just this week. She had a small stroke, and she's doing very well. And my heart goes out to her. I know she's going to be fine, but she had an elevated cholesterol, but she also had an elevated inflammatory marker. And the neurologist is focusing on the cholesterol. He's like, well, we've got to put her on a statin and get that cholesterol down to below 70 now. And yet we don't. The data for preventing strokes by lowering cholesterol is very murky and not well supported. But it is the standard of care in medicine. We've got to do this. If we don't do it, somebody might blame us for not doing it. And by the way, he totally didn't even comment on her inflammatory marker. Her hsCRP was 4.4. That's too high. It shouldn't be that high, because I'm looking at this with a different lens and a different set of A, B, and C associations for causality. I'm looking at that and saying, I got to get her inflammation down. That's the most actionable step I can take to help this patient. I seem to be on a thread with screen exposure and children. Yet another study this week, this one coming out of the KK Women's and Children's Hospital and the National University of Singapore, about early screen exposure and emotional and behavioral problems in children. This study looked at looked at exposures. It looked at how many screens, type of screen, were there screens in the bedroom where the child slept, what were the parents' utilization, and they were studying in particular children who were highly vulnerable. This is children with emotional and behavioral difficulties and neurodevelopmental disorders. So these could be children who had some sort of neurologic problem like epilepsy, but they were already identified as being at risk in the study. Then they did surveys. Then they looked at smartphones, tablets, video game consoles, television, the presence of multiple screen devices in the bedroom, and they found that there was a strong association with sleep disruption and emotional behavioral difficulties in preschool children. They looked at 367 children aged 2 to 5 with neurological development disorders such as autism, language delay, global developmental delay, and other learning disorders. They took a look at the screen use in these children, and they took a look at the scores, and the results were really interesting. More than half were exposed to screens at before the age of 18 months. At least 57% had at least one screen device in their bedrooms. 94 of them exceeded 1 hour of daily average screen time. 73% of them had sleep problems. 60% of them had clinically elevated emotional and behavioral disorders. Now, the next thing that happens is, let's do an intervention study here. This is just correlation. It certainly suggests a substantial risk. But what we need to do now is we need to look at specific behavioral changes. How do we want to change things for the children? How do we want to modify what the parents do? We need to particularly, I think, on the basis of this data, just nix the screens before 18 months of age on everybody. Now, at the bottom of this article, there are some other links, which I have not pulled articles on because I feel like I need to get off this hobby horse, but I just want to read them to you. Smartphones and tablets and adolescents. The more screen time you send, the higher the risk of obesity. Nearly 1 in 5 young Ontario adults shows problematic use of electronic screen devices. As many as 19% of adults aged 18 to 23 experience moderate to severe problematic use of smartphones, tablets, computers, and video game consoles. In other words, they're addicted to them. Here's another. Bedtime use of media devices more than doubles the risk of poor sleep in children. It's probably the blue light. But whatever is going on here, and I'm wondering now, particularly in these neurologically impaired children, I'm wondering about EMF. Is there enough EMF coming off the devices in the bedroom that it could be having an effect? Because remember, below 1 year of age, most children have a porous skull. They don't have a bone around their brain. They've got a soft spot, and that soft spot passes EMF really well. So could some of what we're seeing here be relative to that? If you're going to give your child a screen to play with, put it in airplane mode and don't do it at night at all. Okay, those are probably the two best bits of advice I can give you until we know more. And those things you could probably manage. So if you're a grandparent or a helicopter aunt like I am, then you're going to need to think about how to influence the effect of the parents. And if you're a parent and you're listening to this, well, for goodness sake, think of other strategies. Reading to your child at night has been shown to improve their school performance. If you read them a bedtime story, You'll probably sleep better. They definitely will. You'll improve the bonding, and you'll increase the chance that they read at or above their grade level at second grade. So what's not to love about a bedtime story? Yes, read a book, not the tablet. Thank you very much. That was from Charlie, and he is absolutely right on that. Our next story is weird, but cool, and it conjures up some very interesting, surreal ideas. Discovery looking at West Nile virus and mosquitoes has turned up something really surprising. It turns out that mammalian insulin activates an antiviral immunity pathway in mosquitoes. When the mosquito bites a human, if the human has high insulin levels, it actually changes the way that the virus can be spread. Is that odd or what? Now, this was research done, published today. Let's see, I guess published actually today in the journal Cell Reports. Researchers demonstrated that mammalian insulin activated an antiviral immunity pathway called JAK-STAT. JAK/STAT in mosquitoes. The study was done looking at mosquitoes that spread flaviviruses, and these are West Nile, dengue, and Zika. Of course, we know Zika's been linked to birth defects. West Nile and dengue can result in severe illnesses and even death. So being able to inhibit the spread of these would be wonderful. These researchers found that in the mosquitoes, there's an insulin-like receptor that is activated by human insulin. This is a skeleton key effect. I'm sure that there's another compound made by the mosquitoes that is a modulator of the immune system. But like I said, human insulin acts as a skeleton key and is able to turn the switch. It inhibits the replication of West Nile virus in the flies. And they get the same response in mosquitoes by feeding them blood containing elevated insulin. Activating this receptor was also effective in suppressing dengue and Zika in the insect cells. There's just such a amusing kind of thread that grows out of this. How could we action this? Could we draw blood from people with diabetes? Or could we take human blood and add insulin to it and then leave it out for the mosquitoes to drink? And would that actually, in effect, immunize the mosquitoes against spreading Zika or dengue or Nile? How could we come up with a chemical that we could somehow vector into the mosquitoes? Right now, this is just pure science research. But, you know, that's the value of pure science, is it turns up the stuff that you would never in a million years think of. It's a truth is stranger than fiction phenomenon. But once you get it, once you see it, it's like, well, maybe we can make that fly, Orville. Maybe we can do something with it. The study is looking at something that we've all probably heard of before, venous thromboembolism. This is when people get a blood clot, usually in the leg. And this can, of course, be extremely dangerous if the blood clot breaks off and goes to the lung. But the only treatment for it is to use anticoagulant treatments. Typically, what we'll do is treat for a certain amount of time and then withdraw the drug because the anticoagulants themselves, of course, present some restrictions. If you're on one, you can't take Motrin or aspirin because it might cause enough GI bleeding and that could run away with you. If you're in a car accident or fall down a flight of stairs, you're going to have more bleeding, possibly a significant amount more bleeding. So this could be a very serious problem. And more importantly, we don't know when to stop. So in a study looking at deep venous thrombosis in people who either with or without a blood clot traveling to the lung, they were just trying to figure out how long should we take it, should we stop? And in looking at the conclusions, if it was a blood clot in your leg, 1 year of treatment was enough and your risk of recurrence was only a little bit above the population. if you had your first pulmonary embolism, when you stopped the, if you got it, you could stop taking it. And at 10 years after you stopped, it was only 1.5%. So you have a 98.5% chance of not having a fatal pulmonary embolism if you stop your drug. People who have had recurrent pulmonary embolism, or people who've had a large pulmonary embolism with no good reason, generally stay on these drugs for life. But in people with venous thromboembolism that's just strictly in the lower legs, you probably don't need to do that. And certainly you'd want to go talk to your doctor about possibly discontinuing this. This is pretty interesting too, though many of you have had colonoscopies and you've been found to have polyps. And so the question is, do we need to keep scoping you? And in general, it's been an open question. Do we need to keep doing colonoscopies? How often do we need to do colonoscopies? And does the type of polyp matter? And essentially, just because you have polyps, you don't necessarily need to have a colonoscopy sooner if the type of polyp that you have is a non-advanced adenoma or a small serrated polyp. Your risk of those of cancer is the same as a person who went through their colonoscopy and did not have anything. So it found it all. So if you had an advanced adenoma, that's something bigger than a centimeter, or high-grade dysplasia, you had a much higher risk of advancing the cancer, four times the general population. If you had a non-advanced adenoma, like we're talking about, your risk was 1.2 times that of the general population, which is essentially negligible. Large serrated polyps, anything greater than a centimeter, basically you're looking at an odds ratio of 300%, that is to say, three times a person who had no polyps found. So itty-bitty polyps, small serrated polyps under a centimeter, you don't need that three-year or that five-year. So the pathology is really important. Whether it is a villous adenoma is really important. Those always are risky. And if it's big, it's important. But we're probably overdoing the colonoscopies, and I'm sure if you're one of those people who's had a polyp, you'd be very, very happy to hear that maybe you don't need to keep doing that. We've got just a minute left, so I thought I'd tell you about standing desk myths. Turns out it's a scam. There was a study published in 2015 that found a link between prolonged sitting and cardiovascular disease. But the problem was there were a lot of, it wasn't the sitting. There were other things. So for example, the people who were sitting more were also unemployed, and they spent a lot of time sitting around at home and being depressed. So when you pulled them out of the study, it did not seem to reach statistical significance that sitting at a desk was somehow this highly toxic thing. But it has gone on to sell a lot of standing desks. So it's done some good somewhere. And, you know, it's probably reduced back pain. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. Or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.